Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolfworth. Our topic today is the road south. Seward Highway and the Sterling Highway are really the only way to get out of town in that direction. And they give access to the Kenai Peninsula, Seward, Kenai, Soldotna, Homer, a lot of recreational land, and a lot of economic development for Anchorage. And as I'm sure every single listener knows, there are two lanes, and in the summertime, they can go very slowly when you get stuck behind a line of cars. Also, there are a lot of accidents, a lot of tragedies that take place that we hear about every year. So our topic today is how this route south of Anchorage could be improved, what the prospects of doing that are, and what some of the alternatives and balancing considerations are for these expensive projects, which will inevitably change the landscape as we drive south of Anchorage. And I have two guests in the studio to talk about this today, both from the Alaska Department of Transportation. Wolfgang Jung is a pre-construction engineer. He's the Central Region Design Chief for the Department of Transportation. Thanks for being here, Wolfgang.
No, thank you.
And Shannon McCarthy is the DOT media liaison. Mm-hmm. She is a person who kind of has to know about a lot of things to answer a lot of questions. Thanks for being here, Shannon.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And we are open for your comments and questions on the Seward and Sterling highways. What are your concerns? I mean, what do you, what are your annoyances? What are your worries? I know pretty much all of us use these roads. You can reach us on the phone at 550-8433, 550-8433. If you're outside Anchorage, the toll-free number is 888-353-5752. And the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. Shannon, maybe I'll start with you and just talk about the Alaska Department of Transportation has responsibility for this road, and it's part mm-hmm. of the national highway system. And so that a lot of the money for it comes from that Federal Highway Trust Fund. It's not something we're necessarily paying for out of Alaska tax dollars. And so for that reason, there's mm-hmm. still money available to deal with some of these problems. While Alaska Treasury may be nearing empty, we do have money and we do have the ability to work on this highway, right?
That's correct. Any projects on these roads would be primarily federally funded. We do have to provide a state match. It's typically under 10%. So it's still, it's still definitely an investment. But what we do is we bring, millions of dollars from outside of Alaska to enhance and fix these roads.
Yeah. And it takes a long time because of the processes involved in using those federal dollars, sort of identifying what the problems are, developing solutions, going through an environmental and social process, and then mm-hmm. finally construction. And so as you, I think people get frustrated because they see problems and they want them fixed quickly. But you guys sort of have a very sort of deliberate and I don't want to say bureaucratic, but a step-by-step way to get through these things.
Yeah, it is prescribed by the federal government, all the steps that we have to go through. Typically, a federal aid highway project can be anywhere between 7 and 10 years, sometimes more, and sometimes a little bit less. But there is a lot to consider. We have to consider the environment, and that doesn't mean just the natural environment. It also means the human environment. So communities that we're impacting, homeowners, businesses, and, of course, the natural environment, the Seward in particular, we've got the Cook Inlet beluga whales, in the inlet right next to the road, the railroad. And, of course, we've got both a state park, and then right after that we have a national forest. So there's a lot of considerations that go into any of these projects.
Right, and it's designated as a national scenic byway for obvious reasons. I mean, it's one yes. of the most spectacular roads in the world, probably.
Yeah, and what part of that designation was also for the recreation activities that were along the way. There's there's biking. There's the folks who are out in the water doing the windsurfing. There's fishing, hiking. I could go on and on, but there's a lot of stuff that happens there. It's an attraction for both, national, international visitors, but also for Alaskans. That's where many of us recreate.
It must create a super complex challenge for you guys because you've got a major economic corridor, cargo, people moving at high speeds, and then you've got people all over the place doing recreation in this very narrow little thing. And so I want to get into that as we go on. Wolfgang, you're in charge of essentially designing these roads and the process of picking what the project is going to be and how it's going to be developed. And I'm interested in what some of the major things that you're looking at for the Seward Highway south of Anchorage are, what kind of projects you sort of have on the horizon coming up soon.
Certainly. We have a couple major projects. The Seward Highway 75 to 90 is a 15-mile stretch down by Portage on the big curve there. That's one of our bigger projects. That'll be phased over several different phases. The total is well over $200 million between both the phases, so quite a huge investment.
Wow.
For the department down there. It really involves resurfacing the roadway for the entire 15-mile corridor, 8 complete bridge replacements. The intersection with Portage Road there will be completely redone. We are enhancing recreational access to the Portage River and the Portage Creek, improving drainage and other improvements as
wow.
needed. So,
when you talk about bridge replacements, there's bridges over each of the rivers there, and they're narrow old bridges.
Correct.
And so you're going to be taking and replacing them because they're narrow, or what's the reason for
narrow it? And seismically, you know, we have different design criteria that we have today that we didn't have 40 years ago when the bridges were built.
Right.
So we need to bring them up to current standards. We have, as most people know, a lot of recreational use down there with the fishing activities and such, and the wildlife viewing activities and the wildlife center.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to accommodate a lot of things and moving pieces and stakeholders in that design. So it's a fairly significant investment for us.
It's huge, yeah. And it's also a bottleneck, I think, for cyclists and for non-motorized users, because the bridges are just 2 lanes wide. There's no shoulder there.
That's correct. Yeah, and I think what you're going to really see on these larger projects with both the Seward Highway 75 to 90 and with the Windy Corner project, which is also just south of $100 million, is a lot of enhancements and amenities that aren't specific to the driving traffic, but as much centric to the non-motorized activities going in and around the corridor.
Huh. Well, let's talk about Windy Corner. What's happening there? I think we all know where that is. It's a spectacular spot.
Right. Yeah, certainly a very complex spot. As Shannon mentioned, we've got all kinds of resources that we have to balance as we try to thread the needle for that project. So we have the state park and the national parks, the beluga whales and the critical habitat that they have, the railroad, Department of Natural Resources, very, very much a challenge to broker a middle ground where everybody kind of feels like they've been acknowledged and improvements made on their behalf in that part of that project.
Right. And I know it's an extremely expensive project. And anytime you're building at the foot of that mountain, it's got to be because of the amount of material needed and there's no right of way there. I mean, there's nothing, no flat ground. Any flat ground has to be created.
That's correct. The terrain really dictates in large part the cost of these projects. And I think you're going to see that in the very short distance and the very high dollars that are going to go into the Windy Corner project.
Yeah. So do you have a sense of like dollars per mile in that area?
Well, you're probably looking at in excess of 20 or 30 million per mile.
Wow.
And we're hoping to keep it at that level. So.
Amazing. Well, let's go to a caller. Jeff King is with us from Denali. Jeff, the famous dog rusher, I assume. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, how are you guys today?
Very good. How are you?
Really great. My question is just wondering if there, the National Historic Trail designation of the Iditarod Trail actually goes from Seward all the way to Anchorage and then beyond. I know that Joe Reddington worked real hard to get it recognized. I'm wondering if they know anything about that. As I hear all the people that you're going to be having to talk to, from railroad to buses and transportation costs, I bet the last people you thought you were going to hear from were dog mushers. I'm just curious whether or not the original Iditarod Trail and the national historic nature of the trail goes up through the area we're talking about.
Interesting. Shannon, do you know that?
I wasn't aware of where the trail's located, but I know that the project managers are taking into any kind of trail into account. Wolf, are you familiar with that level of detail on those projects?
No. Hey, Jeff. Wolfgang here. We are familiar with that. That was included in the in the NEPA documents that considered all resources. One of those resources is the Historical Preservation Act that we have to comply with. So the Section 106, like we call it, the State Historical Preservation Office, and our project managers looked into that and made sure that if we were impacting the Iditarod Trail, the historic trail, as you pointed out, that we would mitigate and make sure we made whole any impacts to the trail. So I can't tell you exactly what the mitigation was or how we impacted the trail, but I know you are absolutely correct. It does run along the Turnagain Arm there.
Yeah, and I would love to hear from other listeners who know more about this than I do. I believe that there is a National Forest Service project that was looking at the trail and may have also related to the railroad, since the trail started in Seward. I think part of the trail is the Crow Pass Trail, and I think another part might be the Johnson Pass Trail, but I'm getting a little probably beyond my knowledge base. But I think it's a great question. How do we make all these transportation pieces work together? Jeff, did you have anything to add to that?
Nope. I think you are probably right that historically it probably would not have been the first choice to go along the Turnagain Arm, and I'll bet that the historic trail does go further inland and maybe those passes you mentioned. But just curious, and before you dive in, it was one of the questions I had, and I'll let you take your next caller, and thanks for the information today.
Thanks, bye-bye. Jeff. Yeah, I appreciate it. I love getting a perspective from a sort of an Iditarod legend on the show. It's Hometown Alaska, and we're talking today about the Seward and Sterling Highways. A lot of projects, a lot of big money being spent to improve these roads and to deal with safety and recreational issues and all kinds of stuff. And my guests today are Wolfgang Jung, who is the pre-construction engineer for Department of Transportation, Sandra McCarthy, who is DOT's media liaison. And let me hit you. We were talking a little bit about Windy Corner, and this is a question that came to me by email from Thomas. He's got several questions here, but let me just start with this one. Why is Department of Transportation planning one or two large rock quarries inside Chugach State Park to supply rock for this project? Each quarry would be much larger than the present Bird Creek quarry site parking lot, which is an abomination, according to Thomas, on the National Scenic Byway. Maybe that's a good one for you, Wolfgang. What is that? We talked a little bit about the need for rock or for fill to build along that area where there's no flat ground. Where is that coming from, and how does that affect the state park?
Right. So we are working with Department of Natural Resources, who are the stewards of the Chugach State Park there. We have identified an area just to the north of the Windy Corner project proper where we think an adequate material site and the quality of rock is there and all that stuff. We're working with DNR to figure out if we have a requirement of upwards of 2 million yards of material for the project. So, and in large part, one of the huge costs of building these projects is the transportation of material to the project in the first place. So we estimate that, you know, between that 2 million yards out of the DNR will cost us between 20 and 30 million to get in place. But when we looked at other alternatives, and we actually put out a contract to have an external assessment done of this, actually transporting in the material either by barge or by railroad would double the cost from $40 million upwards to $100 million. So as we're trying to...
Just to move the material?
Just to move and get the material in place. So as we're trying to stretch our limited federal funding dollars as far as we can, this seemed like a very prudent alternative. Again, we had done the Bird Creek material site source previously. I certainly understand Thomas's concern about, you know, what he sees is certainly an impact to the view shed and to the park. I think it's an opportunity, a recreational opportunity. And
it creates a parking lot there for the Bird Ridge Trail.
That's right. It's for the Bird Ridge Trail and for the salmon fishing that occurs on Bird Creek there as well. So we are working, again, very closely with the state parks folks to make sure that the lessons learned on the Bird Creek material site aren't repeated in terms of the mistakes we made, so that our opportunities and how that site might be developed and not impact viewshed-wise. We're literally looking into that as hard as we can. So I certainly understand the concerns, but we really try to, again, stretch our transportation dollars as far as we can and make the most improvements.
So all this material is needed to sort of put out into Turnagain Arm to create some flat fill so that you could have a straighter road, is that it, or wider road?
Right, straighter road. It gets it away from the mountain a little bit. Remember, too, we're also constrained by the railroad. So if we move the road, we also have to move the railroad. So there's material requirements for the railroad as well.
So this project is also moving the railroad alignment, eh?
That's correct. It moves it. It's on the outward side of the road right now, and it'll continue to be. So
is this going to be make a safer road because less ins and outs and maybe more passing zones?
More passing lanes, a separated four lane in this one. We have pedestrian and parking facilities and amenities. We also have incorporated emergency response access. We really, you know, if there's someone out there in the water and they need assistance, there's really not a convenient place for the emergency responders to put in a boat and and run out there and help folks right now. So this actually provides a ramp, an off-ramp under the railroad tracks that they can access and and help people that are in need of assistance out there.
Interesting.
Yeah, I also wanted to bring up that this project, actually all the projects between just past Rabbit Creek and 3 miles south of Girdwood are in our designated highway safety corridor. So safety is something that we're addressing, you know, all along the corridor. And this project in particular, it has a long-term elevated crash risk there. So it's part of the aim of the project.
So part of your job is looking at the number of crashes and sort of why they're happening and then trying to build projects to avoid that. And what you found is this particular spot with that sort of in and out along the cliff is a spot, a dangerous spot.
Right.
Yeah. Actually, Thomas had another part to his question, which is highly relevant to what you just said, Wolfgang. Why won't a DOT pay Chugach State Park fair market value for rock? If it is calculated the value of this rock, then the alternative would be much more competitive. Is that coming into your $40 million versus $100 million, like paying for the rock?
Correct. It's all figured in the calculation. I don't need to know the specifics of the material sales agreements that we've negotiated with Department of Natural Resources. So I can't answer the specifics on how that, you know, what the fair market value or what share we're paying back to DNR.
In any event, you're looking at sort of what would actually cost you as opposed to what it would cost somewhere else.
It's as much, again, the transportation cost, you know, that yard or ton of rock coming 2 miles away versus out in the valley or barged in. Certainly the cost savings is pretty obvious.
All right. I neglected to give out their phone numbers and email addresses for others who have questions. The local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, the number is 888-353-5752. And the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. We're talking about the Seward and Sterling Highways. And Wolfgang, you mentioned that you oversee a tremendous number of projects. Sounds like the Windy Corner and the sort of the Portage area are the two biggies for this, for the Seward Highway. Others that we should mention that are sort of on that scale that are coming up? Shannon?
Wolf, if you want to talk about the turn lanes that are in the Indian and Bird area.
Right. We have an ongoing Highway Safety Improvement Program projects. That line of funding is really tied more to data analysis. So as we've identified places where left turn pockets would reduce or eliminate crash statistical data, we do invest in those types of things. So we're constantly putting in additional rumble strips, wider striping, better signing, reflective or feedback radar speed signs. We're putting in left turn lanes where we can, making a lot of improvements. It's all, of course, in partnership with the person behind the wheel. And so while we can engineer and educate and enforce and, you know, provide emergency services as best we can, it is all in partnership with the person behind the wheel and making sure that we provide them the best opportunity to have a successful and safe trip going from A to B.
Right. Well, it seems to, just from my observation of driving up and down that road, it seems like 10 million times, the driver behavior I see that is very dangerous is people who are driving too fast and passing in unsafe situations, and people who are driving too slow and creating big backups behind them, and sort of creating this situation of it has visibility issues and it has the desire to pass. And frequently there'll be turnouts, and the slow drivers are oblivious and they don't use the turnouts, which is what turned into one of my main pet peeves. Often when there's some kind of a tragedy on the Seward Highway, people start saying, well, why don't we have a four-lane? Because if you had a four-lane divided highway, then the slow and fast traffic would sort itself out. I don't know. Who wants to take that one? Shannon,
I'll
I'm sure you've,
one.
You've talked about that before.
Sure. As I mentioned, this is, you know, a designated highway safety area. Most of our designated highway safety corridors are two-lane roads, fairly high speed. And this is obviously the Seward has that issue. Back in the 1980s, we had a lot of head-on collisions. And so we have been slowly making opportunities for passing, because you're right, the frustration that a driver feels, sometimes they'll make an unsafe pass when maybe a little more patience would be a better choice. Yes, a four-lane divided highway, of course, you know, is a safer option. But considering the space that we have to work there and the considerations of the state park, and of course the National Forest a little further south, and then the beluga whales and things like that, oftentimes we're putting in passing zones, which are a really great option.
Right.
And in both, you know, the north and south directions. So it gives people the opportunity, especially when they know, you know, in 5 miles, I'm going to have a safe area to pass. So I'll hang on. And that's what has really improved safety over the years.
And I've noticed that you've been able to put those in where there's a little bit more flat ground. And so it's not this issue that Wolfgang was talking about of bringing in millions of yards of material and putting them in the ocean, which has got to be the hardest thing you would do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some really tough projects coming up here. Obviously, Windy Corner is a big challenge.
Mm-hmm. And we don't want the whole everything in Alaska to look like superhighway. So there you go. All right. Dave is with us from Anchorage. Dave, did you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I just have a couple of comments. I've been following this project off and on for the last couple of years. And
the Windy Corner project?
Yeah. And it just seems like a monstrosity of a project when you consider that, you know, DOT wants to use 2 million cubic yards of material. They want to build a causeway out into the arm. They're going to have to move the highway. They're going to have to move the railroad. This is all going to probably occur during the summer. It's probably going to take more than a couple of summers to do it. And I'm just curious why no one's really thought about just carving the highway through those two cliff faces and just straightening it out that way.
There's tunnels.
You could end up pulling that material and using that material for other projects along the Seward Highway. And if you just look at a map and look at it, it would just seem like it would be more cost effective to just, you know, basically blast the highway through that rock. And then you could use the current highway as a pullout and or recreation facility, instead of having to create two giant material sites inside the park, which is a legislatively designated park unit, and it's also an LWCF-funded park.
Interesting. So I never heard that idea, Dave. I think that's a really interesting idea. Let me turn to Wolfgang. Ed, did you study that?
Yeah, Dave, and we've got positions available in our engineering section,
yeah.
And I would hire you tomorrow. This is great. Uh-huh. It's great input, Dave. I really appreciate those comments. And believe it or not, that is one of the first alternatives we looked at. The reason we ended up where we're at today and pushing away from the mountain and out into the waterways there a little bit was as a result of the resource, the balancing of the resources. So we had the parks folks who were concerned about the sheep and the wildlife, that cutting into the mountain was going to push those animals back and reduce the recreational opportunities and the viewscape impacts. And we were balancing that with the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service folks who were on the other side of the table with us talking about critical habitat and the beluga whales and the impacts to that environment as well. So what you're seeing at the end here is kind of a negotiated solution in response to all those resources and how best to apply it.
So this was sort of a negotiated between the different resource agencies as to what was the minimal wildlife impact.
Yeah, absolutely. What was that right balance? Huh. So they felt that taking material from that particular corner itself, as opposed to up the road a few miles where we've identified a material site now, was a better solution long-term and more in harmony and in balance with the resources that we had to deal with. So it was absolutely a collaborative event between DOT and the resource agencies that resulted in the alignment that we've got today. But Dave, it's a great point. I wished we could have done what you're talking about. I think it would have saved us even more money in the long
yeah.
run. But
well, I think one of the issues that's ongoing is the fact that there's not a plan for the whole Seward Highway through the park. It's being piecemealed, and there's different projects that are coming online, and it's hard to know how all this is going to fit together over the long term. Because, I mean, ultimately, there's going to be some improvements along the highway over the next 10 years, 20 years, right?
No, absolutely. And as a department, our planning section, what they're working on now is going to be called a planning and environmental linkage study. And these are corridor-based visionary studies that do exactly what you're talking about, Dave. Rather than focusing on small, narrow segments along the corridor, it would take a more holistic approach to the entire corridor, try to decide where we want to develop this thing and how we want to develop it in concert with stakeholders and the public and the resource agencies to develop that long-term vision. What ends up happening, we can do those studies. We can't necessarily go into and parcelize those into smaller projects in the short term just because the limited amount of funding we have, and things do change over time. New environmental laws come into play, new endangered species are identified, new resource agencies or stakeholders are added, and sometimes priorities change as well. So, but that's in the near term. What you're going to see is a these planning and environmental linkage studies. And we're planning on doing those on multiple corridors to do exactly what you're talking about, provide that long-term vision as a department about where we want to go with these national highway system roads.
And does the public have a way to interact with that? I mean, those things where you bring those out and sort of say, what's, because it's a values decision at some point about what we're going to highlight. Shannon?
Yeah, no, there's absolutely an opportunity to comment in that, in the planning and environmental linkage studies.
Yeah. All right, Dave, those were good questions. We have some other callers, so I think we're going to keep moving on, but I appreciate the really, really insightful comments you had, Dave. Let's talk to Diane, who's in Anchorage and had a question or comment.
Yes, it seems logical to move the railroad and the road out into Turning Arm, but what about the tide flats, the composition of the soil, and what about the fact that there's probably an earthquake fault somewhere really nearby?
Yeah, good question. I mean, this road was just really seriously damaged in the 1964 earthquake. Is that one of your design considerations, Wolfgang?
No, absolutely, and it's a great comment, Diana. We really do a lot of geotechnical investigation prior to our finalizing our designs and developing the structural sections for the roads to make sure that what we do build is going to be is going to hold up against seismic activities for now and in the future. So it's definitely in part of our design considerations. I hope that answers your question, Diana.
Yeah,
sounds like they've looked at it. Good question. And still on the same topic, I think Tom has a question or comment. Tom?
Yes, I heard Dave call and ask why the highway couldn't be tunneled through the rock buttresses at Windy Corner. And I don't think Wolfgang answered the question. If that were done, the railroad wouldn't have to be moved, and the highway would simply straighten out those buttresses by tunnels, and that's the way they do it in Switzerland. That was there a year and a half ago, and there are a lot of mountain roads and roads along lakes and so forth that are done that way.
No, that's a good question, Tom, and thank you for asking that. We did assess at a preliminary design level the cost of tunneling. We went back and looked at what the cost for developing the Whittier Tunnel was, and it's actually fairly significant cost.
Yeah.
And what kind of matters to us most now is in a fiscal climate that we're in now, where dwindling state budgets are always challenging our maintenance and operational forces. And our maintenance and operation has been cut back 27% over the last 3 years. Tunnels are very high maintenance activity items. And what we're not trying to do is hand our maintenance and operations folks a large resource requirement when we get done with construction. So, we did look at it. The cost is very high, and the ongoing maintenance and operation costs can be debilitating, too, to our maintenance forces.
Good point, Tom. I was thinking the same one. I'm glad you asked it. It's Hometown Alaska. We are talking about the road south, the Seward and Sterling highways. We've really been focusing on the Seward and particularly on Windy Corner. In the second half, we're going to talk a little bit about the Sterling Highway project, which has been under consideration since, I guess, 1975 in Cooper Landing. The road there is really out of date, but it's a really tough spot to get through. I've got some more interesting comments that have come in via email on the Seward Highway as well. When we come back from a short break, I'm going to give out those phone numbers and email addresses again if you want to get on the show with me and my experts from the Department of Transportation in talking about the Seward and Sterling Highway. So stay with us as Hometown Alaska continues.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
It's Hometown Alaska. We're talking today about the Sterling and Seward Highways with two representatives from the Alaska Department of Transportation, Wolfgang Jung, who is pre-construction engineer, and Shannon McCarthy, who is media liaison. My name is Charles Wolforth, and you can join us on the show if you have a question or a comment. The phone number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, the number is 888-353-5752. And the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And we've got some calls coming in. Dave is going to answer those and get them queued up for us. But Shannon, I wanted to check in with you just on the safety issue. Mm-hmm. I think the safety of the Seward Highway is a big concern for anybody who drives to down for skiing or drives down to the peninsula. We see these headlines about accidents happening with kind of horrifying regularity. Is it as dangerous a road as we kind of think of it? I mean, what do the statistics show us?
Well, it is a concern. We wouldn't call it a dangerous road because, of course, if it was a dangerous road, we would shut it down and fix it, you know, whatever was causing that. But it does have safety challenges. As we've been talking about, what makes it a challenge in terms of engineering is also what contributes to its safety concerns. So you have a two-lane highway. The fact that we have fluctuations of traffic, it goes from an average of about just under 9,000 vehicles a day during any average day of the year. But actually in July tells us a different story. We're going upwards in 22,000 vehicles a day on that corridor between Anchorage and Girdwood. And once you have that kind of traffic on a two-lane highway, it starts to break down. People can't make left-hand turns. You know, you can have rear-end risk. People passing unsafe, as you had mentioned before. All those things start to go into it. So slowly and surely, we have been making those safety improvements to the road. Some things have been big. Some things are little. But all of it has contributed. And we're actually down by about a one-third in terms of head-on collisions for this highway. And then
so stuff you've been doing is working.
It has been working, yeah. And also, I think the fact that the public has now understands the risk on that road, that they're making better choices. Hmm. So some things have, you know, improved. Overall, collisions are down about 38%. So a lot of improvement, but you know, when you're still bouncing between 2 and 4 fatalities every year, that's 2 and 4 too many.
That's a lot. Yeah. So Joe wrote an email about Seward Highway design. And he points out that a lot of these efforts are laudable, including the rumble strips and safety corridors and traffic enforcement. But he doesn't feel they directly address the problem, which is snow, ice, rain, darkness, mobile devices, and all the other things that cause drivers to stray over the line, causing head-on collision. And he asks, why not try Jersey barriers, which are these concrete barriers that run down the middle of a road? His quite a lengthy email, which I'll forward to you, and I can't read it all now, but he has quite a bit of research here that shows that these barriers are used elsewhere in snowy climates, and they work in various situations, and sort of suggests, why don't we try it here?
We've actually studied that extensively. It's certainly, they have worked in other places, and there are probably some locations that would work well in Alaska. Unfortunately, the Seward Highway in particular, particularly between Anchorage and Girdwood, is problematic. And it's because we have that two-lane highway with very narrow shoulders. So if you put a Jersey barrier down the middle, you're actually taking, even though it takes about 2 feet of space, most drivers are going to give that an additional 2 feet. They're going to pull away a little bit. Mm. And then all of a sudden you have cars impacting beyond the fog line. So where bikers are normally operating, or if a car breaks down and needs to pull off, then all of a sudden the drivers are in that area, which is not safe for bikers or for people who are, you know, under distress with a car, maybe having to change a tire.
I see. So it's just that the road itself isn't wide enough to add that.
Yeah, it really isn't. And then if you had those Jersey barriers and you had a crash, you have another object for people to unfortunately crash into. And then you'd have a real bottleneck in terms of emergency services having, you know, getting down there and helping the injured.
Right. Makes sense. Ryan has a question about alternative transportation. Ryan?
Am I on there?
You are. Please go ahead.
Sorry, you got caught in the middle of eating here. okay, sorry. Have you guys thought about alternatives to the motor vehicles? That's a little bit outside the box, but like personal rapid transit or group rapid transit, like an elevated system that simply you're at a different grade.
Huh. So it seems kind of like a light rail thing, or I'm not totally sure what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, sort of. They're individual cars, so each car is a personal rapid transit system. Each car holds, like, say, at a maximum of four people, whereas a group rapid transit might hold at the maximum of eight. A group rapid transit, they have a system in West Virginia University.
Yeah.
Have you thought of it costs about 10 million miles. $10 million per mile on a one-way line. Have you thought of that?
Interesting. I mean, I would guess that maybe the population density might not be enough for something like that.
Well, it'd be a line haul system, so it would be all the way, a straight shot.
Interesting. Shannon, anything to add on that? It sounds like something that's
I was actually
futuristic.
Thinking about this, right? These ideas come up from time to time, and I know that our transportation engineers would design anything that they were asked to. And what we haven't seen yet is that move toward that, you know, in terms of our society. I think that what we have seen a move toward is the driverless vehicles and electric cars and things like that. So we're still designing for that. But, you know, should this, you know, our society either here in Alaska or nationwide take that turn, DOT is pretty darn flexible and these engineers can design.
We have railroad tracks down there. We could start with that. Thanks, Ryan. We're going to go to John now, who is calling and has a comment about the Sterling Highway, which is something I've wanted to get to, and we've been kind of stuck on the Seward Highway so far. John?
Hi, thank you. I was curious about the construction project that's going on the Sterling Highway. It's pretty substantial, and I wanted to know if there is going to be a link across the Kenai River to, the Funny River Road, I think. And the other question is the status of the bypass around Cooper Landing. Thank you.
Two big questions. Can you take the first one, Shannon? Is that you're talking about sort of down south of Kenai?
Right. Are you referring to the 58, milepost 58, the one that's under construction right now?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Are you referring to the Sterling Highway project that's under construction right now?
Oh, yeah, that huge project where they're really... it's pretty substantial.
It's about 22 miles of repaving, passing lanes. We're also doing some wildlife underpasses. Do you have more information?
Yeah, and there's been ongoing work on that southern part of the Sterling putting in these pullouts, which are nicely designed so vehicles can pull out. They don't have to come to a dead stop. I have to say, having driven the Sterling Highway a number of times this summer, not enough people are using them. It just drives you nuts to see a big line of cars pass a pullout like that. But you guys, I see you're trying to deal with that, and you've cut down a lot of brush along the side of the road to deal with the moose. We always get annoyed having to wait for the flagman, but that's it goes with the territory. Do you want to do a quick overview, Wolfgang, of the other part of his question, which was about the Cooper Landing project and what the current status of it is?
Right. We're really working with FHWA full speed right now to try and come to a final identified preferred alternative that would take the form of what we would call the record of decision. Right now, the Federal Highways folks are saying they're optimistic that will come to pass in 2018. So we're hoping to have a final solution that we can start phasing and coming up with an engineered solution in the near term.
And this is going to be, we can't predict exactly what that will be, but it will be some kind of bypass around, right? Because in the earlier phases of this NEPA process, you've looked at simply improving the road that exists. And because it's right in the river, environmentally, that's proved to be a non-starter. Is that true?
Right. You've really got a lot of constraints and limitations on really improving that roadway on the current alignment that it's in. You've got right adjacent, it follows the river for quite a ways there. That's a resource we're really sensitive to. You've got, it actually has one of the highest densities in Alaska of historical things that we have to be sensitive to also. You've also got a community that it passes through that's fairly close to the road. So if we go in and widen and start adding lanes, and all of a sudden you eliminate much of the community you were trying to help.
I see.
And so we don't want to do that either. So many of the alternatives that you're seeing developed as part of this environmental impact statement are a reflection of those constraints and limitations and do, in fact, follow other alignments away from the existing alignment and as far as they're providing a solution for the problem.
Is there, I've written about this project, and it's something that's concerned me both as a cyclist and as a driver, and have been driving through it, obviously, and when it's been in need of improvement for some 40 years. I guess the EIS has been almost, I don't know if it's the longest running in the country, but it's probably got to be close to it. Shannon's nodding.
Yeah.
1975 to the present. And obviously, there's still a long way to go because it's still a lot of complex issues, still extremely expensive. Is it possible to do some kind of improvement to a lower design standard for the existing road just to deal with some of the really severe safety problems there and lack of non-motorized facilities there, knowing that it'll just end up being a country road that is maybe sort of bypassed later, but at least would get us help a little bit?
I wish I could say, other than, you know, pavement preservation level projects where we're really just going in and freshening up the actual blacktop on the road, what happens when you lock down a corridor with an environmental impact statement or any other NEPA document, you're really precluding any other significant improvements in that corridor until you come to a final resolution on the document. So,
so that's part of the just the legal process.
It's part of the strings attached process when we use federal funding. So that's why we're pushing so hard to get ahead of this thing. The actual environmental impact statement that we're doing now is really actually a supplemental environmental impact statement. The first part of the road was actually already constructed, and that's the piece that it ends at the Sunrise Inn there right at Quartz Creek.
Right. It's got a nice passing lane.
And comes back towards Anchorage five or six miles. So that was actually in the original EIS. The supplemental portion of the EIS that we're doing right now addresses from Quartz Creek on pass to the Juno Creek and or South G or where whatever alternative we end up with.
So, right.
Yeah.
And it makes more sense to keep this EIS alive versus closing it out and starting anew because we've done so much work on it already. So.
Right. I get it. It's very frustrating, though. Vince has a question from Anchorage. Vince?
Hey, Ed. Thanks, Charles. In full disclosure, I'm also a property owner in Cooper Landing.
All right.
I've been following this really closely. And what was selected, or I heard him just referred to, actually, Charles, your idea of something, you know, less stringent that would improve what's there and going with the new EIS, there's a lot of people that actually support that because even though it's a 40-year-long EIS, a lot of people think it's so flawed that it can't be overcome without a brand new look at the whole thing. But that notwithstanding, the G alternative is the one that right now DOT's been pushing. And there's been, you know, everyone and their mother is lined up saying that's the worst possible and the most expensive one and doesn't actually accomplish all of the goals. It comes back in at mile 51 before Gwynn's Curve, which is where all the major crash data is and all that. And I think most people think the one that makes the most sense is the Juno Creek alternative. And recently, Secretary Chow was up here with Senator Sullivan, where they announced that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had said that they would be willing to immediately execute negotiations with Cook Inlet Regional if the Juno Creek alternative was chosen in 2018. So I'm wondering with all that, the borough opposes the G alternative, user groups, guides, the Kenai River sportsmen, business interests, all kinds of people. If that's, you know, if they've changed their mind or when we'll know if they're going to potentially change to the Juno Creek alternative.
Who can take that question? Shannon? No, Wolfgang?
Oh, okay. Hey, Vince. Yeah, Vince, thanks for the call and great questions and great points. Right now, what has happened is just like you've articulated, Secretary Chow did come on a visit, and the Secretary of the Interior has issued a notification to the federal highways and to the state that they would, if Juno Creek would be the identified least overall harm alternative, that a land swap between SERI and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service could actually take place. That's good news in terms of moving the project closer to a Juno Creek alternative. Again, I can't predict what the Record of Decision is going to come out with as far as a preferred alternative in terms of least overall harm. But that certainly helped the case in getting the NEPA document heading in that direction.
And who actually makes that decision?
Well, the Federal Highways Administration they're responsible and charged with the NEPA final determination. So Fed Highways is the one responsible for making that decision. The state really is in support of providing all the resources and documents and studies for that allow the Federal Highways Administration to actually make that final determination. So the other thing that's recently happened, too, is that the Forest Service, in their estimate of how the impacts to the Resurrection Trail of the Juneau Creek alternative has assessed the ability to mitigate that has changed from low to moderate. And when that changed, that also changes the math of how the Federal Highway Administration determines which least overall harm alternative they're going to end up with. So things seem to be trending, Vince, in the direction of a Juneau Creek. Again, you're right, G South, as soon as a year ago, was really where we thought we were heading. But with those changes by the Secretary of Interior, in concert with our congressional delegation, in concert with the Secretary of Interior, and also the Forest Service change in mitigation abilities for the Resurrection Trail, do seem to indicate that it may be heading towards a Juneau Creek outcome.
And I know there's others out there who would disagree with the different routes, and welcome to call in. One of the problems we have as being a radio show is that we can't depict to you what these different routes are. So for the listeners who are not 100% familiar with this, and probably a little bit at sea, if you can Google the Cooper Landing and the map and look at those if you want to. But for the moment, I'd like to move on to some other questions. It's Hometown Alaska. The phone number here is 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. Got two representatives from Department of Transportation, Wolfgang Jung and Shannon McCarthy, to talk about the route south of Anchorage, the Seward and Sterling Highways, and lots of questions coming from listeners. Right now, I would like to go to Chris, who's been waiting very patiently with a comment or question. Chris?
Yeah. I was wondering if anybody looked at the idea of a bridge across turning an arm that would bypass the trouble points of the Seward Highway and the Sterling Highway and make those huge expensive projects to improve those unnecessary.
Interesting concept. I guess we've just been through spending $100 million or so and many, many years studying the Knick Arm Crossing. What about a Turnagain Arm Crossing? Shannon?
You know, I've heard it brought up as an idea, but it's certainly not a project that we're working on right now. It would be a significant investment of funds, as you know.
Mildly, yeah.
Yeah. So, and you are dealing with the same issues that you would deal with over on the Knick Arm in terms of tides and things like that. So we are talking about an engineering investment if the state ever wanted to do that.
I think you'd land in a National Wildlife Refuge, too, on the other side, which would not
I
be
believe
simple.
So, yeah.
Yeah, the refuge is a resource that's a really tough thing to get beyond.
Yeah.
The wilderness areas are also difficult, and not to mention the cost. I think the Knick Arm, you know, conservatively was $1 billion.
Right.
And so certainly
and this one would be at least as long as that.
Yeah. Oh, at least as long. So
yeah.
I think if, you know, in a perfect world, it's a great idea in terms of providing additional circulation and the ability to limit the traffic in the Cooper Landing areas and maybe reinvest that money at other places. But
yeah. One of the issues that, Chris, that we come into with these is that the money that we have to spend here is allocated through a formula from the federal government based on how much money comes in for gas taxes. Alaska already gets more than our share, but it's still a set sum of money. And unless somebody in the federal government drops a lot of more money on us to do one of these big bridge projects, would take many years of our allocation. So we would have no other projects in the state then. So
no, absolutely. And we really suffer. We don't have a very large population base. So mm-hmm. you see large mega projects going on in the lower 48 in public-private partnerships, but those are in large part because economically they work out. And a toll authority approach is a realistic approach to building large infrastructure. But with 650,000 people and a small number of those located in the south central area, it becomes problematic to make the math work.
The toll would have to be too high, right?
It would.
And that was one of the problems with Knick Arm. All right, Kelly has a call from Whittier. Kelly?
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to kind of bring a note up to the 511, and especially when there is an accident on the Seward Highway and how to get updates. A lot of times we have a business in Whittier, so maybe I'm in Anchorage or in Whittier waiting to get on the highway. We hear there's an accident, but it's hard to get follow-up to know when, well, sometimes you're sitting in the accident or you know, when's it okay to get back on the highway so that you're not clogging it up. And I get the initial being about the accident, but then it's really hard to find follow-up information.
Kelly, thank you. This is Shannon. I hear you on that. I've often actually been stuck in those backups myself, and you're right. You know, we've gotten much better at working with APD and the state troopers, so their system works better with our system. But if those aren't updated, then they don't get updated unless I have. One time I was sitting in the backup and I didn't have connectivity, and I knew the road was reopening. And I couldn't get a message back out on Facebook or on 511. So it's definitely a complaint we've heard, and we are working on it. And sometimes it is, especially if it occurs on a Friday night, and if I'm stuck in that, then oftentimes I can't get that reopened message back up.
So that's you personally who has to do it.
Sometimes, yeah.
I think it'd be neat to have some kind of a text message system. I would sign up for text messages to say, hey, there's a 30-minute delay or there's an unknown delay on Seward Highway, and I wouldn't mind getting them when I didn't need them if I got them once when I did. So it might be an idea to try.
Right. Well, so the nice thing is that APD and troopers now use Nixle, and so they have keywords that our 511 system pulls.
I see.
But oftentimes the reopening is difficult because they might reopen it and they don't necessarily have the time. It might be midnight or 11 o'clock at night, and they, they may not have a chance to call back to dispatch, or they may have a connectivity problem in the route. So sometimes that message does not get out on a timely basis.
So many people, so many people inconvenienced and so much time lost. It seems like there's got to be some way, and it's not on you, but there's got to be some way to make that better. Quick question comes in from Tom. Will the Seward redo save the infamous cliffside water pipe? We're all becoming aware of this now that there's water coming out of the cliff down there along the Seward Highway, and people are going out there and collecting it, and I'm not sure why they're doing that or if it's even safe to do it. Doesn't seem like very safe to cross the road there. Shannon?
Well, we're really familiar. It's at milepost 109, and we're really familiar with this issue. What we do have are people that pull off on that. There's a little pull out on right across the road, or sometimes people are pulling out on the cliffside, and then sometimes crossing when it's not safe to do so. So there's that challenge. It is surface water. And I know that some people have tested it and hasn't come back with, what you might or fear would be in surface water. But it is surface water that's trickling through the rocks. There are a number of websites that are dedicated to highway springs around the nation. And this is actually included on that. So it is popular. But we are concerned. Our geologist has mentioned that it's an area of significant rockfall. Shortly after the
crash.
Something
could fall on somebody. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So shortly after we had that crash this summer, we had some rock fall. It was, bigger than a couple footballs each. And while those don't look big, if they fall on your head, they really are. They can really hurt you. So we are asking people, especially after high wind events and heavy rain events, that's when we see lots of rock fall along the corridor. And we are asking people to be particularly safe in that time. Maybe if they don't have to collect water, might be a good time to avoid it.
So if this will this Windy Corner project affect that? Would that be eliminated, or do you know?
It's actually, Windy Corner is just north of it.
Okay. Here's a question from Lois Epstein, who is an engineer and a local environmentalist, which is about the Sterling Highway at Cooper Landing. Has DOT looked at a cantilever highway option, I-70 in Colorado in Glenwood Canyon, which looks like Cooper Landing stretch with similar issues, might meet everyone's concerns, creating a safer road with four lanes, wildlife and viewshed protection, belugas and turning an arm, salmon and Kenai Lake, etc. May make sense not to do these road upgrades on the cheap and forego 1,400 miles of new roads in the Arctic, which hasn't gotten much attention, but state DNR is pushing for that. So I guess this idea is kind of trying to build something up so you can avoid the river and avoid the avoid the lands. Is that something that was part of your NEPA or your investigation?
I'm not aware that was one of the options that they looked at. Cantilevered roads, however, are really another name for a bridge. Mm-hmm. And the cost of bridge per square foot is 10 times that of road structure. So we're already looking at initial estimates in the low 300 millions for any one of the alternatives that ends up in the record of decision for the Cooper Landing area. So the thought of adding a decimal point over to that number seems a little unlikely, again, given the limited amount of federal funding we get each year. So,
and just as in ballpark terms, what is our federal funding allocation?
So we get around $500 million a year from FHWA and another $200 million a year-ish from FAA. So, we really are an organization charged with bringing in 700 plus million a year into the state to keep the economic engine going and to keep our infrastructure moving and as efficiently and safely as possible. So,
but then when you talk about a project like the one you described where you're replacing these bridges around Portage and putting in pedestrian facilities and putting in these recreational facilities as being a $300 million project, you're talking like more than half of your highway money for the year.
That's correct. And typically on the larger projects like that, you'll see them phased. So they oftentimes end up being in 100-ish plus or minus million-dollar segments. So Cooper Landing being a $300 million-plus dollar project right now, you could probably expect to see that in at least three segments and maybe four by the time it's all done.
Which means many, many years of inconvenience, right, Shannon? I mean, that there's going to be construction going on for a long time. There always is, it seems like.
There always is the construction. Our construction section does try to, mitigate, especially in plan for events so that, for instance, down in the Kenai, we typically pull our construction projects off as much as we can during the 4th of July weekend because we know that's a big fishing weekend. So we try to be really cognizant of impacts, especially in the summertime.
Mm-hmm. The Cooper Landing project, though, most of that alignment is not on the existing alignment. So while it will take several years to implement, the actual
right.
impact
it'll be
of the
off,
traveling
off to the side, right?
Right.
Here's a question that I like. We're almost out of time. Why don't we have those blinking signs where it says you're going over the speed limit? Mm-hmm. This person asked why we don't have them for saying you're going too slow on the highway and that you should be pulling out and using the pullouts. I don't know if anybody's ever suggested that before.
I haven't gotten that suggestion before, but certainly I have seen people that are going a bit slow. And that's what our safety challenge is for that road, is that you're mixing this high-speed mm-hmm. traffic, people who are,
they may need to be going slow, but they should pull out if they
That's right. That's right.
And we do have the signs that say a delay of five vehicles or more is illegal. So there is signage that speaks to that, but the blinking mm-hmm. signs don't.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So that's an interesting idea. You could put that in your process to think about. Well, anything to we've just got 30 seconds left. I want to thank you both for being here. Shannon, do you have any sort of last message for people who want to learn more or be involved?
Yeah, we have websites for our larger projects. You can either find them just by Googling them, or you can go to our department website, and we have projects listed out there. So, and then you can always shoot us an email at dotask@alaska.gov. I think it's dot.ask@alaska.gov.
All right. Well, thanks so much for both of you for being here. It's been really interesting, and I'm impressed at how many questions you're able to field. Wolfgang Jung was here. He's the DOT pre-construction engineer on these projects. Thanks for being here, Wolfgang.
You're welcome.
And Shannon McCarthy, a DOT media liaison who has all the other information. She has to know everything. Thanks for being here, Shannon.
Thanks for the invitation.
And thank you for your calls and your interest in today's show. Next week, we're planning to have a discussion about welcoming new people to Anchorage. So please tune in for that. For Hometown Alaska, I'm Charles Wolforth.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.